Have you ever had that feeling, that specific nagging feeling of spiritual restlessness?
You know the one.
Yeah. You're sitting in a service, maybe you're reading a book on faith, and you just feel stuck.
Like you're on a treadmill.
Exactly. A lot of effort, you know, a lot of movement, but you're not actually getting anywhere.
It's the classic maintenance trap. You're just keeping the machine running, but the actual transformation, it isn't happening.
Right. And today we're doing a deep dive into a set of documents that claims this isn't just a you problem. It's a bigger misunderstanding of what the goal of faith even is.
We're looking at a guide from the Mission and Discipleship Committee of the UPCSA. It's called Going for Growth.
And the core idea here is fascinating. It's about moving from maintenance to missional.
And just to be clear, missional doesn't mean you have to, you know, quit your job and move halfway across the world. It's about a shift in your identity right where you are.
It's the journey from just being a church member to being a disciple. So today, we want to unpack what that word disciple actually means.
And we'll look at something called kingdom math, which is honestly kind of mind-blowing when you see the numbers.
And then walk through five specific holy habits that act as the soil for this kind of growth. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
I want to start with the definition, because when I say discipleship, I think for most of us, we immediately picture a classroom.
A six-week course, a workbook.
Yeah, fill in the blanks, you listen to a lecture, and boom, you've been discipled. You get a certificate.
The academic model, it treats faith like it's just information you download, but the source material is really adamant that this is the wrong way to look at it.
So it's not a curriculum you graduate from?
Not at all. You don't get a diploma in Jesus and then retire. The guide pushes for a much more organic definition. It uses analogies like an apprentice with a master or a coach with an athlete.
There was one analogy in there that I just loved. The tracker.
The tracker following a spore in the bush.
Yes. Just think about that image. If you're tracking an animal, you're not following a paved road. You're looking for fresh signs.
A broken twig. A footprint.
Exactly. The disciple is the one learning to see what the master tracker sees. And stepping where the master steps.
It's a dynamic, active relationship. You can't track from a classroom. You have to be out in the field. And the source makes a great point that this field work is communal. It points us to the Antioch model.
Oh, this is a great piece of history from Acts chapter 11.
Right.
So the early believers are scattered because of persecution. The natural human reaction would be to hide, right? Go underground.
Form a little huddle and wait for things to cool down.
But they don't. The text says they went about, and I love this phrase from the source, they were gossiping the gospel.
Gossiping the gospel. It sounds a little irreverent, doesn't it?
It does, but think about it. You don't schedule a meeting to gossip. It just spills out of you because the news is too big to keep in.
And that's how the message spread. It wasn't formal preaching. It was just excited, irrepressible conversation. And significantly, it was there in Antioch that they were first called Christians.
Their identity came from their activity. But here's where it gets really interesting to me. The source highlights this massive cultural reversal in how the relationship even begins.
Okay.
In the Greco-Roman world, if you wanted to be wise, you went shopping for a philosopher. The student chose the teacher.
Right. You'd listen to the Stoics and the Epicureans and decide who you wanted to follow.
But Jesus completely flips the script.
He chooses them. He says in John, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." And then in Matthew, the famous invitation, "Come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of people."
That phrase, "I will make you," it sounds simple, but the source points out there's some really heavy lifting happening in the original Greek there.
There is. The root word is poie.
Poie.
It's a verb that means to shape, to craft, to mold. It implies an active creative process by an artist. He's not saying, "I'll give you a reading list." He's saying, "I will shape you into something new."
And the source connects this to the noun form of the word, which is poema.
Yes, which is where we get our word poem. It means a masterpiece, a work of art. And this links directly to Ephesians, "For we are God's handiwork. We are his poema."
Wow. That is a staggering thought, that a disciple isn't just a student. You're a work of art in progress.
A poem being written by the master. And poems need editing. That's the discipleship process.
So this poem, it's not static. The source outlines a very specific progression. Come, follow, learn, become, abide, obey, bear fruit, and finally go.
And the danger, as the source argues, is getting stuck at come or learn.
That's the treadmill again.
Exactly. The whole point is to get to go. If you don't reach go, the process is incomplete. And this brings us to the concept of kingdom math.
Okay. I have to admit, when I saw math, I sort of glazed over, but this is actually pretty cool. We usually think of church growth as addition. Plus 5 here, plus 2 there.
That's linear growth. The source calls this Timothy math and argues for multiplication. It's based on 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul tells Timothy to entrust what he's learned to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others.
Let's trace that. So you have Paul, that's generation 1. He teaches Timothy, generation 2.
Mm-hmm.
Timothy teaches reliable people, that's 3. And they teach others, generation 4.
4 generations of replication in a single verse. Now, if every disciple becomes a discipler...
Let's run the actual numbers from the source.
Mm-hmm.
Say one person disciples just 3 people. And they do a good job, so those 3 go out and each disciple 3 more.
And so on.
By the time you get to 7 steps down that line, you don't have 21 people. You have 2,187 people.
It's exponential. It just explodes. And that's the key takeaway. A healthy disciple has to become a multiplier. If the flow stops with you, the chain breaks. The math fails.
That's a lot of pressure. I mean, most people feel like they can barely manage their own lives, let alone multiply themselves into thousands.
It would be exhausting if it were all on you. But that's where we pivot to the how. The source introduces 5 holy habits, and it frames them not as laws, but as cultivated soil.
Cultivated soil. I like that image.
You can't force a seed to grow. You can't pull on the sprout. But you can till the soil, water it, remove the weeds. You create the environment for growth. These habits are how we tend the soil so the Spirit can do that poyer work.
Okay, let's walk through them. They're divided into inflow and outflow. The first 3 are about inflow. Habit number 1, reading the Word.
The compass. The Psalms call the Word a lamp for my feet.
I've always loved that.
Yeah.
It's a lamp, not a floodlight. A lamp just shows you where to put your foot next so you don't trip.
It's for immediate navigation. But the source makes a crucial distinction here between reading for information and reading for formation.
What's the difference in practice?
Reading for information is data entry. You're scanning for facts, maybe ammunition for an argument. Reading for formation is letting the text read you. It cites Hebrews saying the word is alive and active, and it judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart.
That's a bit intimidating, isn't it? The idea that the book is reading me.
It can be. It's like a mirror. It exposes the things we try to hide. Not always comfortable, but it's necessary for healing.
Which leads right into habit number 2, prayer. And again, the guide tries to rescue this from just being a list of demands.
Right. It defines prayer fundamentally as relationship, simply talking to God.
I really connected with the visual analogy they used here, the camera.
The camera metaphor. It's a beautiful way to understand it.
Can you break that down?
Sure. So think of an old manual camera. First, you have to focus. That means turning your attention away from distractions onto God. Second, you open the shutter. That's opening your heart, being vulnerable.
Yeah.
Then you just let the light shine in. You don't create the image yourself. The light hits the film and an image is imprinted.
So the goal of prayer isn't just to be heard. It's to be imprinted, to be changed.
Exactly. It changes the metric of a good prayer life from, did I get what I wanted, to, am I becoming more like the one I'm talking to?
Okay, so then we have habit number 3, fellowship. And this isn't just about coffee after the service.
No. This is referencing the kibbutz spirit of the early church in Acts chapter 2.
The kibbutz spirit. That implies a really deep shared life.
It was. The book of Acts says they had everything in common. They sold property to give to anyone in need. It was radical generosity.
Iron sharpens iron, right? You can't sharpen a knife on a marshmallow. You need that friction.
And real community has friction. But that friction, combined with deep support, creates what the text calls awe. People looked at that early community and were drawn in because the love was so tangible.
So we have the inflow, the word, prayer, fellowship. We're fed, imprinted, supported. But if we stop there...
We become spiritually obese. We take in, but we never work it off. So we have to pivot to the outflow habits.
Habit number 4 is obedience to the Spirit. Now, this assumes God is actually speaking to us today.
The premise is that a living relationship has to be two-way. God speaks, but we have to learn to tune in.
And this brings us back to the bush, the game drive analogy.
Yes, I love this one.
It's so true. You're in the Jeep looking for lions. If you're a rookie, like me, you see nothing, just grass and bushes. But the guide stops and points to a shadow and says, leopard.
Because the guide has trained eyes. The source says hearing the Spirit is just like that. God's prompting, the wildlife is always there, but we're often spiritually blind to it.
So how do you get those guide eyes? How do you learn to spot the leopard?
Through obedience. It's a feedback loop. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says, "My sheep listen to my voice and they follow me." The way you learn to hear the big commands is by obeying the tiny nudges.
Obedience is the hearing aid.
That's a great way to put it. It clarifies the voice. Which leads us to the final habit, the ultimate destination. Habit number 5, witness in service.
And this is where the source uses that geography lesson, the two seas.
The Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, both are in the same region, both fed by the same river, the Jordan.
But they couldn't be more different.
Exactly. The Sea of Galilee has an inflow and an outflow. Water comes in, water goes out, and the result, it is teeming with life.
And the Dead Sea.
It's the lowest point on Earth. The water flows in, but it has no way out. It just stays there and evaporates. The minerals concentrate until nothing can live in it.
That is a haunting image for a believer.
Mm-hmm.
To have all that inflow, all that teaching and worship, and still be a Dead Sea.
If you have no outflow, you stagnate. The salt that's supposed to preserve the world just makes you toxic.
So the cure is the Great Commission and service.
Yes. Go and make disciples. But also serve. Like Jesus washing feet. The source quotes someone saying, "Earn the right to speak by a personal friendship."
You wash the feet first. You build a relationship. Then witnessing isn't a sales pitch. It's just telling a friend you found water in the desert.
It's an invitation.
So we have the definition, the math, the habits. It sounds like a solid plan. But I want to close on the warning label the source slaps on this, because they don't pretend it's easy.
No. They talk about the cost of the calling.
It's not a popular sermon topic.
But it's essential. Jesus says in Matthew, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me."
Deny themselves. That is so countercultural today.
It is. The source uses the imagery of the sword and the forge, saying that faith is like gold refined by fire. Discipleship is a hammer and anvil process.
That completely reframes suffering, doesn't it? When things get hard, it might not mean God has left you. It might mean you're on the anvil.
Exactly. It's the poiré process again. The shaping requires heat.
There's a witty line in the source about Romans 12, the verse about being a living sacrifice.
Oh, yeah. The author notes the problem with a living sacrifice is that it tends to crawl off the altar.
It's funny because it's so true. Being a living sacrifice means you have to choose to stay on that altar every single morning.
Every day is a new decision. Okay, God, shape me, use me, even if it hurts.
So as we wrap up, what's the synthesis here?
I think it comes back to that timeline. Come, follow, learn, become, abide, obey, bear fruit, go. Discipleship is a trajectory. It's about movement.
And for you listening right now, the challenge is to find yourself on that line.
Right. To be honest about it. Are you at come? That's fine. But don't stay there. Are you at learn? Have you been learning for 20 years, but never really moved to obey?
And are you breaking the kingdom math? Are you the end of the line?
It's a heavy question, but it's the only one that matters if we want to escape that maintenance trap.
I want to leave everyone with that image of the two seas. It's something to really reflect on this week.
What's the question?
Are you a river that flows, bringing life everywhere it touches? Or are you a reservoir that is slowly, slowly becoming a Dead Sea?
That's the question.
Thanks for diving in with us. We'll see you next time.